This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Natalie Goldberg. She's the author of 14 books, including Writing Down the Bones, which has just come out in its 30th anniversary edition. Her new book is The Great Spring, Writing, Zen, and This Zigzag Life. She's a Zen practitioner and teacher, and she has a lot of wonderful events coming up. She'll be speaking this Wednesday, that's tomorrow, at 5:30 at the Upaya Zen Center here in Santa Fe, which will be followed by a big dinner celebration. The public is invited to that. Then on Friday, she will be in Taos. The mayor of Taos has declared it Natalie Goldberg Day, and she's getting a medal. And then on Saturday, there are some more public events at the Mabel Dodge Lujan House, a discussion in the morning about writing down the bones. People can come and talk about how that book has affected them. And then a writing workshop in the afternoon. And finally, on the 10th of March at 6 in the evening, she will be reading at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
It's great to have you back, and congratulations on all of these accomplishments and the reissuing of the book and the new book. It's a lot. It's a milestone in your life.
Yes, it is. Actually, though, it wasn't reissued, Writing Down the Bones. It's been in print all these 30 years.
Right.
But they're celebrating it extra by, you know, the 30th anniversary.
With a new preface and some new materials in it. So you have devoted your life to writing and to Zen practice. And tell us about these two things. Are these intertwined for you? Are they part of some larger practice?
Yeah, it's totally integrated, the two of them. I don't see them as separate. And really, if anything was original about Writing Down the Bones, I put together the word writing and practice. Because years ago, people thought if you were a writer, you were on the top of a mountain, hit by lightning, and inspired. And it was only available to very few. In Writing Down the Bones, I explain that all it takes is practice, showing up, picking up the pen, or now the computer, but keep doing it. So that it's integrated, Zen practice and writing practice.
That book, I think, represented for many people not so much an instruction on how to write, but an opening to the imperative to write. So I'm going to write, and I'm going to find my way in this practice of writing.
Well, it turns out many, many people want to write. And they don't all want to write the great American novel, but it's a human right to read and write. And it wasn't available. I knew that I wanted to be a writer, but I couldn't figure out how you do it. And I knew I wasn't going to learn it in school, that I needed to go outside, in a way, the box and figure it out on my own. And really, what are the tools of writing? Pen, paper, and the human mind. The more you understand the mind, the more you can use it for writing. And that's what I did with my Zen practice.
So were you already, when you wrote Writing Down the Bones, an experienced Zen practitioner?
Yes. When I'd practiced for 6 years intensely with a Japanese Zen master named Katagiri Roshi. I had also, when I wrote this, I was also a poet for 13 years. And it's a secret, but a 10-minute writing practice, if you're really on, you can type it up later, and it's about a page-long poem. So really, poetry was my way in.
When you say you wanted to be a writer, but you were a poet, do you think of those things as separate things?
No, I don't. I was already figuring it out. You know, when you write a book, I was doing writing practice for 13 years, but it just felt time that I share it with the world.
So the writing practice in writing down the bones was what you taught yourself over those 13 years.
Yes, exactly. I did timed writings, and I learned that it works better if you write with somebody else because you have to be honest. You can cheat and quit, but when you're writing with someone else, you have to keep your hand going. I also learned start reading aloud your work with no comment and this is definitely Zen, no good or bad. You know, we've developed such strong critics inside ourselves that a lot of times people want to write, but they can't because the critic's at our shoulder. That you misspelled that. Oh, that's stupid. They're going to think you're an idiot. And pretty much you just shut up. My summer vacation, it was really fun. It was very interesting. That's what my high school composition sounded like because I didn't know I could write the real details of my summer. And nobody in school was telling me I could.
So did you have a consistent writing partner that you read aloud to? Was that part of this 13 years of development?
I grabbed anybody that came along. There was a woman when I was working on my novel, Banana Rose. I'd never written a novel before, and it was hard. And she just came up to me and said, I read Writing Down the Bones, and I want to write with you. I said, great, meet me at 9 o'clock in the morning, every morning at the Garden Restaurant on the plaza in Taos, and I'll meet you there. And we did our own writing, but I showed up. And I said, don't call me and tell me if you're not coming, because then I had to show up anyway. And once I was there, I just did it.
Did she tend to show up?
She did show up quite a bit. She'd stay about an hour, and then she'd leave, and I'd be there for about 3 hours.
So in this process of silencing your inner critic and letting yourself go, what's the next step after that?
Oh, that's a long step. When you say silencing the inner critic, I don't think you ever silence it, but you learn to have a relationship with it, and you also learn not to pay attention to it. And sometimes what I call monkey mind, has a very strong voice, you know, and very logical things. Natalie, this is ridiculous. You know, it gets very logical, but you have to keep catching it. So over time, you just keep writing. I say that I teach a priori writing before essays, before novels, before journals, and before journalism. And if you get a strong spine and you understand the basics, you can go anywhere. And I often say, that's none of my business. Do writing practice for 2 years at least, and then follow what you love. If you read a lot of novels, maybe you want to write a novel.
But that a priori is something that, in your view, needs to be given years of practice before you start writing that novel or that essay for publication?
I think it's a good idea because you get to really know your voice. You get to know what your real passions are. Because once you start a book, it takes a long time. So you have to really want to do it and not do 20 pages and then quit, do another book 20 pages. So when you really practice for a long time, you understand the parameters. And you also have a confidence in yourself. In a way, you can listen to people then criticize your work, and you're not tossed away. Do you know what I mean? Then you don't quit forever, and I'll never do it again. You get it. Oh, they said this was lousy. I know what to do. Take out my pen and paper. Go. 30 minutes. I remember.
Right. When did you get to the point where your inner critic became a useful editor?
The inner critic never becomes a useful editor. It doesn't want to write. It doesn't want you to expand and get bigger. It's trying to keep you safe. Shut up. Don't say anything. Don't speak up. So that never changes over. But you learn to have a relationship and not get tossed away by it. But what happens, I often write and don't reread what I've written for at least a month. because in that month, it's sort of the blood has dried and you can see it more easily. And actually, when you have some distance, you can see where it's good and where it isn't. But you don't get carried away, oh, I'm no good, I'm a failure. Just, okay, this works. Sometimes out of a whole notebook I used to fill, I'd get one good line. But that good line I would use to start writing practices.
Right. And the skill of discerning which is that good line is its whole own skill set.
Well, really, it pops out at you. When you have a little distance, it's obvious. It really is obvious what pops out.
And so where did you go from there? You'd fill a notebook a month or 2 months or however longer later, you would reread these notebooks. I have filled, Natalie, so many journals starting at the age of 13, and they're so cringeworthy. You don't ever want to go back and read the stuff you wrote at that age.
Exactly. So why don't you throw them out?
That's a very good question.
People are shocked when I say I throw my notebooks out.
Yeah.
I reread them. It's important to reread them because you get to have a relationship with your mind. You see what you do. For instance, I notice that I complain an enormous amount. Probably 3/4 of my notebook is complaining. So now it's so boring when I start to complain, I just am not interested. So I put dash. What I really want to say is I drop to a deeper level and I write something else.
That's sort of interesting psychologically. So what I hear is that underneath complaining is something more substantial.
Exactly, because complaining is discursive mind, yada, yada, yada. I don't like this wallpaper. Oh, my foot hurts. Oh, I need new shoes. Why am I eating corn tonight? I don't want corn. I don't like so-and-so. I have to pay my electric bill. That's all discursive thinking. Below discursive thinking is the way we really see, think, and feel. And that's connected to ourselves and connected to what's around us.
And that's where sometimes those original details, which become interesting writing, start to emerge.
Absolutely, yeah. Because then the detail is a detail, and I don't have an opinion about it. It becomes its own life. What I say to students is, you get out of the way, and writing does writing.
We're talking to Natalie Goldberg. This is something that so many authors have said to the point where one begins to realize that the writing process seems to be tapping into something outside of oneself or something bigger than oneself. Or as you said, you get out of the way. Well, whose way?
Exactly. That's a great question. That's a perfect Zen question.
Yeah.
I see it as my discursive thinking gets out of the way. Writing does writing. And it's not that I get out of myself. I get more deeply in myself. But when I'm more deeply in myself, I'm also not separate from all things. I'm interconnected and interpenetrated. So it's not inside or outside. You disappear.
When you do that, is your experience, for example, you're writing a novel, and one of the things that so many writers say is they might set up some characters and situations, and then those characters take on a life of their own, and they do things that you didn't intend, or that you didn't push them to, or you try to make them do this, and they're like, I'm not going to do that. What is that?
That is great. That's when you're lucky, and you know you're really writing a novel. Because it has a life of its own. And it's different parts of us. And we have to step back and let those parts of us live. And what's great about writing a novel, which, by the way, I think is a very hard thing to do, is that those parts can live and you don't have to become a doctor. You can just, that part of you can become a doctor, or that part of you can become an engineer or a mechanic. Or a cook, you know, and you don't have to run yourself crazy by trying to do all of those things. You can sit at the table, move your pen across the page, and all those people can live inside you.
When you do that, particularly in the novel form, which is different from the memoir form in many important ways, how much research do you do?
Well, you know, I've only written one novel.
Okay.
And I hope I never have to write another one. It wasn't a natural form for me.
Mm-hmm.
But some writers have to do a lot of research. You know, let's say you have a period piece that you don't know. Often, you'd usually have to do a bunch of research.
So, in your new book, The Great Spring, Writing Zen and This Zigzag Life, one of the early essays in the book is about your going to Japan. And it's so interesting to me because you meet this very educated Japanese couple who look at you and you're like, you're studying Zen? Like, why? Why would you do that? It was kind of like, you know, what was that? Like, how did they see Zen? Why did they think it was a weird thing to do?
Well, first I asked them, how did you learn English? And they said, oh, we were over in England for a few years because the husband was getting a PhD in Immanuel Kant. And I said, Immanuel Kant? I went to St. John's. I studied Immanuel Kant. I don't care about him. We want to study your Dogen. And he went, oh, that's too hard. And then I, not knowing that Zen wasn't looked at as a great thing in Japan, I mentioned that I was a Zen student, and I actually was on my way to a monastery. And they went, I could see they distanced themselves from me, and they said, ugh, Zen, you don't want to be a Zen person. I said, why not? He said, they die young.
Which is so interesting, because you write, yeah, they kind of do.
Yeah, some of them I know have died young, because it's such a hard, raw practice. And also in the old days, like Dogen died at 50, because people died younger. But it was a hard life. And but it is hard. And it was very revealing for me, having this conversation with these people.
What is so sort of fascinating and weird about that is that a Japanese man would say, oh, Dogen is too hard. We might say Immanuel Kant is too hard.
Exactly. It was totally in reverse.
Yeah.
But, you know, nothing is too hard when you really want it. And I think we're always curious about the other. So Dogen, I'm willing to read, even though he's very hard. And they were willing to read Immanuel Kant. They wanted to understand what Immanuel Kant had because he's steeped in the Western culture.
And one wonders whether, or I found myself wondering whether, when you try to understand a person or a way of thinking or a school of philosophy from a completely different culture, whether, I mean, you might be attracted to it because it's the other, but you don't even have a clue what you're missing.
You don't have a clue about anything. You just dive in and do the best you can.
You went to a Japanese monastery around that time. How was it like and unlike the Zen that you practiced in the U.S.?
Well, it was tough. It was really tough. The monastery, the Zen I practiced in Minnesota with the Japanese Zen master was very tough. This was tougher. And tougher because we used to get up at 4:30 and 5. They got up at 3 in the Japanese monastery.
That's when you go to bed.
I know. I didn't speak, nobody spoke English. And they wake up at 3, they sit in the zendo for a half hour, and then they all jump up and run around the town streets before anybody else wakes up as exercise, very vigorous running. They come back into another room, and they do army calisthenics. And it's nonstop from then on. Also, the eating. Anything that is not eaten gets laid over to the next meal. So in other words, the dinner we had was all the week's food that didn't get eaten, cooked to a high boil.
So that if it had mold on it, they'd just sort of boil it off.
Yes, exactly.
Was it gross?
You know, you shut up. What you learn is not to have an opinion. If you had an opinion, you'd go crazy.
Yeah.
So finally, I just wanted to survive. So I just ate when we were going to eat. And I drank water when I drank water. I had to let go because otherwise, and that's the idea. They push you all the way so that the only way to survive is to let go.
And so in that situation, did you find yourself really letting go?
At points, yes, I did. I did. And other points, I was very excited, looking forward to leaving.
And then you left and bought a bag of M&Ms at the train station, and you saw one of the monks there, and you hit it, and he had a candy bar in his hand, and you started laughing. And it makes you wonder, like, what is that? I mean, if you're doing a practice that is so hard that when you come out of it, you have to do something, not that a bag of M&Ms is such a big deal, but do something very reactive.
Uh-huh.
Are you creating balance or are you creating extremes?
That's human nature. We always want, if I'm eating really, really well for a while, I want to rebel. I have to go to Haagen-Dazs. You know, I think what you learn is you learn about human nature and you learn about your own nature. And yes, it was extreme, but it's carried my life ever since. It's given me, a place to stand.
What do you mean by that?
I think I know who I am. I mean, not completely. Nobody knows who they are. But I know what matters to me and how I'm going to live my life. And really, the Great Spring is about my life backed by Zen and writing.
What does the title of The Great Spring mean?
Well, there are two meanings. How wonderful spring is, especially when I was in Minnesota, where it would freeze go to 20 below and would not come back for 4 or 5 months. That when you'd really believe spring could never come again. It was not possible.
And then even if it did, all of nature was so dead.
Yes, dead, dead, that it couldn't come back. And yet it would come back. So in a way, the Minnesota spring is the most glorious of all. So there's that, the Great Spring. And then also the Great Spring is in Japan, refers to the Great Enlightenment, when you really wake up. It's almost like an unfreezing of where you were blind. And the Great Spring refers to enlightenment. So it has two meanings.
I think one of the funny paradoxes about the experience of enlightenment, which I certainly can't say that I have ever known personally, and I think most of us probably haven't, but those who have or claim they have, there's an inexplicability about it, and there's an ordinariness about it.
Yes, I think that's true. Yeah, that it's right in front of your nose. We just don't. I think that's what's so amazing, is that any kind of awakening. But we all have small awakenings. I guess Zen students sometimes are pushing for them, whereas most people are walking around. You know, they hit their head on a door, and suddenly they understand something, but they don't hold on to it and they go on. Yes, it is ordinary, and I think people get it, have awakenings often, but I think Zen people are pushing for them. And then finally, even the Zen people realize, oh, let go, stop it.
So then why bother? Why don't you just cut to the chase and just be?
Yeah, that would be nice. Can you? I have a lot of trouble just being.
You know, this is a question that I think so many people, and perhaps particularly here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, who have tried a lot of things and who have done a lot of spiritual practices and have had the experience of hitting their head against a wall of, this is really hard, and why am I doing this when I could be hanging out? I could be doing things or being with people that I love. I mean, how is it going to make my quality of life better? And I think that's a question that, especially when it gets really hard, if at the end it's ordinary life anyway.
Yeah, but I don't think it's separate. Like, I don't think of Zen as separate from ordinary life.
No, but I mean, you're sitting on a cushion for back-breaking, knee-destroying hours at a time.
Yeah, you have to want it bad.
Want what?
You know that the life, you know, out here just eating at a cafe day after day isn't enough for you. And there's something else going on. Or often people go to it because they're in a lot of pain and their life as it is doesn't work. But the best is when you go back and forth and you bring what you learn in the cushion out to the world. Really, that's necessary.
We're talking to Natalie Goldberg, author of many books, including The Great Spring and Writing Down the Bones, which is in its 30th anniversary edition. And one of the things that you talk about in the book as, I don't know if it felt like an awakening for you, it was an interesting story that had a lot of permutations to it, was getting bitten by a dog in France.
Oh, yeah.
And it seemed like when it happened and after it happened, you went into some kind of both survival and, like, it, the way you write about it, almost ecstatic.
Yes, it was luminous.
Sensation. Yeah.
But we need to say that I was with Thich Nhat Hanh in Plum Village practicing for a month. I left, it was in France, I left and went with some friends traveling to Aix-en-Provence. And I was very high, and in a way... High from the practice. It's more Vietnamese practice than Japanese practice. Japanese practice is very much a body practice. You sit still. And I'd done that for 12 years. And then when I went with Thich Nhat Hanh, he blew my mind because we only sat a half hour in the morning and a half hour in the evening. And the rest of the time, we just hung out. Well, I don't know if it was the juxtaposition of both of them.
That sounds good.
Yeah, that I went really big. But I couldn't come down. I wasn't grounded. And so I was on this vacation, and I saw in the distance a building that I thought was a cafe that I was going to write in. And I went up to the cafe. I went up to the door, and it turned out it was a private house. And a guard dog... Thank God he was chained, jumped out and bit me really in my calf, a really big bite. And I jumped out of his arena and actually ran back to the monastery where the nuns helped me. And it's the monastery where Van Gogh was there for a while because he went crazy. And... for some reason, because I was connected not just to the pain of my leg, but to the luminous life of everything, I seemed to go through it totally okay. I had to fly back emergency, but I noticed there was a full moon. I don't want to say it was a great time, or it was a very deep time for me.
And had some real low points after the initial wound and treatment.
Yes, definitely. And it was not easy. It wasn't easy. But I took care of it moment by moment, which was wonderful. I don't often do that or always do that. I'd like to do it that way. But, you know, when you get a bad dog bite and have to fly away, you know, leave your vacation. But every moment was my vacation.
Did it affect how you feel about dogs?
I've never liked dogs that much to begin with. I know that's a horrible thing to say in Santa Fe, but I'm saying it also so people realize not everybody is in love with dogs.
Yeah, no, it's so true.
Yeah, I was brought up with grandparents from Russia and Poland. And they, you know, ran from pogroms. And often the Russians and the Polish used dogs to attack them. So they were afraid of dogs.
Yeah. How do you feel that your Jewishness, your Jewish heritage, intersects with your Zen practice? Two, I think, very different spiritual traditions, or maybe there's some common ground somewhere?
I don't think I look for the common ground. I just let Zen be Zen and my Judaism be Judaism. I've never had a conflict, though. And a long time ago, Katagiri Roshi said to me, why don't you study Judaism? Why don't you go and really study it? And he said, if you get to the heart of Judaism, you'll find Zen. So that was wonderful.
What did that mean to you? Like, did you do that?
Yeah, I actually did. I was very open at that time. I was in my 30s, and I really didn't know. I was culturally deeply Jewish and very proud of it, but I didn't know a lot about the religion. So I found rabbis, and I really tried. And it really enriched my life.
At St. John's, we had once a preceptorial where we studied these mystical rabbis,
yes.
A whole series of them, including the Baal Shem Tov, but others as well. And in there's a whole world of mysticism, reincarnation, and sort of aphoristic wisdom, which
yes.
I didn't know was there.
Yeah. I think in every religion, there's a really sincere heart, and it gets covered up a lot, you know, with politics, socialization, all of that. But, you know, the urgency in the religion is something coming from a very deep place.
Did you find the heart of Zen?
Yes. But it's not a heart. You know, you have this idea that you'll find the heart of Zen and you can grab it in your hand like a bleeding heart. No, you become permeated with it.
One of the things that you have done with your life is write these books, write memoir, teach, practice, and have that whole intertwining. And this practice, which has gone over now, what, 4 going on 5 decades?
Yes, yeah.
When you write memoir, I would imagine that over the years, the practice of writing memoir changes. For example, do you focus on different topics? Do you think of yourself a different way? Does the quality of how you look at your past change?
I think that happens not because of Zen. It's about getting older.
Yeah, that's what
I mean.
And
that changes you. And hopefully, what I hope is that my writing gets better and better so that I can capture it more closely and clearly.
The reason I ask is because years ago, I went to some kind of writing workshop, and I think it was the teacher, I don't remember very well, but somebody remarked how if you tell a 25-year-old, tell us your life story, it'll go on for 45 minutes. And if you tell a 60-year-old, tell us your life story, they might take 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And one has lived so much longer than the other, but is so much more perhaps concise, or has a lot of things already compartmentalized so they don't need to be dragged out as much.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. I'll have to think about it. I don't know what to say, actually. Maybe for me, I've already said so much. And once I've said it, it's over. You know, whereas a young 20-year-old has so much energy and enthusiasm.
And is grappling
with so much.
With so much.
Yes, yeah.
We're talking to author Natalie Goldberg. Now, teaching has been such a big part of your life, and I wanted to ask you about, you wrote this book, Writing Down the Bones, 30 plus years ago now, which encapsulated for others the practice that you had found for yourself, and it was a smashing success, and it changed many people's lives who read it and who did those practices. And I was wondering what that was like for you. I mean, I sort of imagine you going from being a struggling writer to being a celebrity and, you know, dealing with a lot of new experiences because of that.
It was very hard. It was actually very, very hard. I was very naive. I was straight out of a monastery. And really, if you read the book and you're a Zen person, all I'm doing is talking about Zen. And I think the genius of it is just that I put practice and writing together. But it was very hard for me. I didn't know what it meant to just take off. I was afraid that if I was successful, I had this old idea that I wasn't really an artist. I wasn't really a writer. It's absurd. You know, writers should be poor.
Yeah.
That was one thing.
Right,
Another thing was everybody wanted me, but it made me more and more lonely because they didn't want me. They had recognized my book, so they wanted me to recognize their stories. And they'd come at me. You know, I lived in Brooklyn, blah, blah, blah. I don't even know these people. And also, when you write a book, you're one person. The book goes out to a million people. And they all thought they knew me.
Right.
And so I felt very overwhelmed. And it was really helpful. I lived on a mesa in Taos with a dirt road that you could never get through. Because people showed up in Taos looking for me. But it protected me.
When you did go out and you did presumably give workshops and things like that and people's stories started pouring out, was that fulfilling for you?
I love to teach. I'm a teacher. I have a teaching certificate, which is my most proud thing that I have, and I've taught in the public schools. I deeply love to teach, and I was teaching writing now, so I wanted them to really understand it.
Did you feel like you were giving them Zen as you gave them writing?
Oh, I knew I was only giving them Zen. But it was kosher, though. It was okay, because the Zen I was giving them was non-denominational. You know, it wasn't about a religion,
right.
But it was just about becoming present. And really, I think of myself as a Dharma teacher.
So you mentioned a moment ago the word success, and that was something that I have been thinking about, you know, in relation to the kind of success that you had with this book and success in general. What does that term mean to you, and how has that, the meaning of success, evolved for you over the years?
What comes up immediately when you say that is, now I can enjoy my success. Whereas it was very uncomfortable, and I kept thinking I had to write another book. I do keep writing books, but there was an urge somehow I had to keep proving myself that it wasn't okay to just be successful. And it wasn't okay to be ambitious. But now I enjoy it. You know, I was very much brought up that I was going to marry a doctor or a lawyer and have children, and I didn't follow that path. So it compounded the problem. And success now is the success that you can enjoy it.
What do you think is the role of ambition in spiritual practice?
Ambition is a good thing. You know, we've given it such a bad rap. If it's used in a good way for understanding, to have kind consideration for all sentient beings, that's a great ambition. You have to have a little mojo to keep practicing, to keep doing anything you do.
I noticed that one of the themes, or at least for me, maybe I'm reading into this, but it seems like one of the themes that comes up over and over is food.
Yes, I like to eat, yes. And it's embarrassing in writing down the bones. I think chocolate is on every other page.
Really?
Yeah. But hopefully I'm a little more discreet in the great spring. But I do like to eat. And I'll tell you a funny story. When I was writing the great spring, I had some chocolate in my studio on a bookshelf. And then I bought all kinds, so it would seduce me to go to the studio to write. And then, you know, once I'm really into the writing, I don't need the chocolate. So I said, Nat, we're not getting any more chocolate, and, you know, that's enough. And one day, I think I was writing about something that was really made me nervous. I thought, I got to get some chocolate. So I went to the shelf, and there was only one old stale piece. And I thought, oh, that's okay. And then I looked. There were ants on it. It was spring. I thought, oh, but this is how desperate I was. I thought, oh, I'll just run it underwater. I'll brush off the ants and eat it. Well, I stuck it in my mouth. There were ants inside the chocolate, and they bit me in the inside of my mouth.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, Natalie, you are an addict. This is disgusting.
Well, it's, I guess part of this also is that I've had an experience multiple times of having a really great meal and feeling a deep sense of inner peace. And it's the kind of deep sense of inner peace that one would imagine you would get after a great meditation session. But it's really just satiation. And I've never understood the relationship between that kind of sensuous satiation and the kind of spiritual peace that one is looking for through, you know, spiritual practice.
Well, I think there's probably no difference, except maybe a practice person knows that the next day they're going to want the meal again. And then the meal won't be as great because it was that one time. So can you enjoy it, feel totally satisfied, and let go? That's what's hard. We want more and more.
We're talking to Natalie Goldberg about her old book, Writing Down the Bones, and her new book, The Great Spring. Would you like to read a little bit from the new book?
Yes, I'd love to. I thought I'd read the preface, which ties together Bones and The Great Spring, because they're both coming out with the same publisher at the same time. People come up to me and say, I love your book. Mostly I know what they mean, but I become difficult and a bit ornery. Which one, I ask? I've written 14. I ought to feel grateful that I'm still being read, that my work has continued, and simply taken the pleasure that I might have helped someone with the early inspired energy of Writing Down the Bones, my first book on practice. It is auspicious that with the great spring I have returned to Shambhala, its publisher. Like a big circle closing, the arc is completed. The 30-year anniversary special edition of Writing Down the Bones and this new book will be released at the same time. I joke that Big Brother Bones will introduce the public to Little Sister Spring. But in actuality, the Great Spring holds a more mature knowing, saying in an even clearer, more experienced way what is important. I have searched through these stories to find answers, if answers are ever possible, about who I am and who I have become, standing on the ground of being, driven by the practice of Zen and writing. There are many ways to manifest our true life. In Bones, I promise to continue. Here are some of the ways I have done so. Please join me in this deep practice in honoring all of our moments. I cannot do it alone. We are here, but not forever.
Natalie Goldberg, you have fairly recently had some quite serious health challenges, and I wondered if you could talk about how these practices of Zen and writing have helped you through that time.
Well, that's a good question. Actually, The Great Spring was written in 2014 when, for 14 months, I was dealing with cancer. And what I learned was, even in the middle of cancer, cancer isn't the whole universe. Of course, you have to take care of it, and you have to get chemo or infusions and meet with doctors and deal with, you know, your horror. But I learned that right in the middle of it, you can do something else. And writing is one of the things. I couldn't maybe have run up and down mountains, but how wonderful that writing was my practice, because it didn't take a lot of physical energy to write. And so in the afternoons, after I got infusions and stuff, I was alone in my living room, and I just slowly wrote a book, quietly, without telling anybody.
And this book came out of that.
Yes.
And yet you don't, it's not really in any way a book about illness.
No, it's not about illness. It's about the way I've lived my life. And in a way, I wanted to write about that just in case I didn't make it out. I wanted you to know how I played tennis or played ball with my father at 8 years old or how I went to Japan. So I'm telling you about my life backed by Zen and writing.
When you say that the new book is a more mature work, when you go back to the old book, when you go back, I mean, one of the 14 books that you've written, when you go back to writing down the bones, how does it hold up for you? I imagine that you revisited it pretty deeply when you were working on the 30th anniversary edition.
No. No. I wrote the introduction, and I have to revisit it in the next 2 days because, you know, I'm going to be on the road and I'm going to talk at Upaya Zen Center. But I think I never look back at my books. I'm always on the next book. But I will say anytime, you know, sometimes someone will come up to me and carry on about bones so much. I'll go home and think, what are they carrying on about? And I'll open it up to a chapter and I'll read it and I'll think, oh, it still holds. It really does hold. Really, all I know is writing practice. I never went beyond that. I never did workshopping. That is the way writing is taught in this country, where you bring in finished work and you criticize each other's work. I've never done any of that. I only do what I say in writing down the bones. So it definitely is held up over the years. It's just, as a writer, and I think this is true of most writers, they're always more interested in the last book they wrote or the next book they're going to write.
Natalie Goldberg is author of 14 books, including Writing Down the Bones, which is having its 30th anniversary edition right about now. Her new book is called The Great Spring, Writing Zen and the Zigzag Life. And once again, she will be speaking on Wednesday, that's tomorrow, at 5:30 at the Upaya Zen Center here in Santa Fe, followed by a big dinner to which the public is invited. And then on Friday, she will be in Taos. The mayor of Taos has declared it Natalie Goldberg Day. Saturday, the public is invited to the Mabel Dodge Lujan House for a discussion in the morning and a writing workshop in the afternoon. And finally, on the 10th of March at 6 in the evening, she will be reading at Collected Works Bookstore. Thank you so much for taking all this time with us and for being on the Radio Cafe.
This was just a pleasure. This is my first interview of the book.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Good, good. Well, it's great to have you.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.